Chapter 9, Civil War and Reconstruction. Henry K. Burgoyne, Jr., son of one of North Carolina's richest planters, knew early in his life what he wanted to be, a soldier. At age 15, he studied at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. At age 16, he graduated from the university in Chapel Hill. He continued his training at the Virginia Military Institute, VMI, at 17. His VMI cadet group guarded the condemned John Brown, the famous abolitionist whose attack on Harper's Ferry, Virginia, helped bring on the Civil War. When the Civil War began, Burgoyne became an officer in the Confederate Army. He was a major at 19, a colonel at 20. Burgoyne's drills led to complaints from many of his soldiers. But at his regiment's first fight, the soldiers' ability to follow orders helped them escape a northern trap. His great coolness and efficiency in combat made his troops twice elect him their commander, even though their generals did not want boy colonels. His regiment, the 26th North Carolina, became one of the very best in the state. For 2 years, it fought to defend North Carolina's coastal plain. In the summer of 1863, the 26th was part of the Confederate invasion of Pennsylvania. On the first day of the Battle of Gettysburg, the regiment went head-to-head with the Iron Brigade, the toughest unit in the Union Army. The 26th sent 800 men into the fight. 20 minutes later, almost 600 had been killed or wounded. 11 soldiers who carried the regimental flag that day were taken down. Colonel Burgoyne became the 12th. Within seconds of taking up the flag, he took a bullet through his lungs. He died 2 hours later. Just as Colonel Burgoyne died at the beginning of his adulthood, so North Carolina seemed to take a mortal blow, just as it was becoming the state it wanted to be. The old North state reluctantly joined the Confederate cause, then suffered some of the greatest losses of any Southern state. Courage was not confined to the battlefield. Slaves fled to freedom, farm wives stood up to cheating neighbors, and some men in the West defied the Confederacy, believing, like their Regulator ancestors, that their government was not acting in their best interests. The debate, fueled once again by sectionalism, continued after the war during the period called Reconstruction. Section 1. Sectionalism and Secession. As you read, look for disagreements about abolition within the state, North Carolinians' support for compromises that kept the Union intact, issues that led to North Carolina's secession, and the following terms: North Carolina Manumission Society, North Carolina Colonization Society, Secession, Confederate States of America, and Unionist. The prosperity of the 1850s aggravated the divisions over slavery in North Carolina. Western areas of the state grew less cotton and more wheat, which meant that those areas needed slaves less than they had in the past. In turn, the huge increases in cotton production turned Easterners into defenders of slavery. Henry K. Burgoyne, Sr., the father of the boy colonel, had been a critic of slavery before 1830. He wrote a pamphlet defending it in 1860. North Carolinians and Abolition. After the War of 1812, North Carolinians and other Americans argued the great question of the day: should slavery be continued? In 1820, North Carolina's leadership supported the Missouri Compromise, which resulted in a line being drawn westward from the southern border of Missouri. As discussed in Chapter 8, below the line, slavery could continue in new states like Arkansas. Above the line, in places like Wisconsin, it could not. The line pleased Southerners more than Northerners. By the 1830s, the number of opponents to slavery had grown in the North. These abolitionists wanted to abolish slavery in the United States as soon as possible. As with everything else, North Carolinians disagreed among themselves about abolition. North Carolina was notable for having more of its citizens speak out against slavery than any other Southern state. Most of the anti-slavery sentiment was in the western section of the state. This was logical because slaveholding was far less widespread west of the Fall Line. One group consistently worked to end slavery. In 1816, Quakers in the Uwharries had formed the North Carolina Manumission Society, which raise money to buy slaves from their masters. Manumission is the act of releasing someone from slavery. The society helped more than 1,000 blacks in the 15 years of its operation. Some Quakers also joined the North Carolina Colonization Society, which worked to pay the ship passage back to Africa for free blacks who wished to move there. Other Quakers moved to Indiana to get away from slavery and its effects. Many, like Levi Coffin and his family, became involved with the Underground Railroad, the series of roads, houses, river crossings, and people who helped Southern slaves escape to the North or to Canada. After 1830, however, most North Carolinians strongly supported slavery. They were following the lead of citizens in other Southern states who were beginning to profit from the growing demand for cotton. Southerners believed that cheap slave labor was the key reason cotton was so profitable. As North Carolina grew prosperous after 1835, the defenders of slavery gained a stronger hold on the state. A newspaper declared in 1837 that the state's support was unalterable, firm, fixed, and decided. Citizens who thought otherwise did so at their peril. Soon after, missionaries of the abolitionist-friendly church, the Wesleyans, came into Randolph County to set up congregations, they were run out of the state. One Uari native, Benjamin Hedrick, lost his job as a professor at the university when he admitted that he agreed with the abolitionists. Hedrick barely escaped being tarred and feathered by a mob in Salisbury. One opponent of slavery was Hinton Rowan Helper, a native of Davie County. Helper spent his young adulthood traveling the country, even going to California to look for gold in 1849. He concluded from his travels that places without slavery provided more prosperity for more people. While working in Salisbury in 1857, Helper wrote a long essay called The Impending Crisis of the South, where he argued that slavery worked against the interests of many North Carolinians. "It makes us poor," wrote Helper, "of farm families like his. Poverty makes us ignorant. Ignorance makes us wretched. And wretchedness makes us wicked." Once Helper's book was published, he too had to leave the state. North Carolinians and the Mexican War. While North Carolina worked hard to shed its Rip Van Winkle image in the 1830s and 1840s, many Americans rushed to the American West to settle new lands and set up new lives. As Americans came to believe in the idea of manifest destiny, they chose a North Carolinian who strongly supported that idea to be their president. James K. Polk was born near Charlotte and educated at the university. He, like Andrew Jackson, had moved to Tennessee at an early age. Polk was elected president in 1844. To fulfill manifest destiny, Polk moved to add Texas to the United States and acquire other western territory. As discussed in Chapter 8, when Mexico, angry about the annexation, cut ties with the United States, we declared war on Mexico in May of 1846. Although several thousand North Carolinians volunteered to fight in the war, some of our western leaders spoke out against the conflict. One congressman called the Mexican War an unjust war against a weak neighbor. One reason the Whigs lost control of the state after 1850 was the impression that they had been against the war with Mexico. The nation came close to civil war in 1850 because of the dispute over what to do with the lands taken from Mexico. North Carolina worshipers that year at a camp meeting, religious gathering, at Rock Spring held special services to pray for peace. Some North Carolinians advocated joining the rest of the South in forming a new, separate nation. The state, however, failed to send delegates to a convention in Nashville, Tennessee, where secession, the action to be taken if a state decided to leave the Union, was under consideration. No war occurred, however. Congress passed the Compromise of 1850, which allowed California to enter the Union as a free state. It also guaranteed the protection of slavery with a stronger fugitive slave law that ordered every American citizen to return escaped slaves. The 1860 election. Although North Carolina was divided over slavery, the state would not side with the North. In 1860, the Republican Party, the new political organization that replaced the Whig Party, nominated Abraham Lincoln of Illinois as its candidate for president. There were no Republicans in North Carolina to support him. In fact, Lincoln was not even on the ballot in North Carolina or any other southern state. The other candidates in the election were John Bell of Tennessee, Constitutional Union Party, John Breckinridge of Kentucky, Southern Democratic Party, and Stephen A. Douglas of Illinois, Northern Democratic Party. John Breckinridge carried North Carolina, but Abraham Lincoln received more votes across the country. After Lincoln won the election, his outspoken opposition to the growth of slavery convinced Southerners that they had to act to protect the means of their livelihood. South Carolina and six other Southern states seceded from the Union. In early 1861, they formed the Confederate States of America. The failure of Unionism. North Carolina, however, hesitated to join the Confederacy. Because cotton and slaves were not as widespread in the state, Unionists, those leaders who wanted to stay in the Union, were more influential. To oppose them, secessionists called for an election to choose delegates to a convention to discuss what to do. The February 28, 1861 vote concerning the convention showed just how much North Carolina was divided. The people voted 47,323 to 46,672 against holding the convention. The highest Unionist returns were in counties like Randolph and Wilkes in the West. The largest turnouts for secession were in places like Edgecombe and Wayne counties in the East. Because only 30 of 86 counties voted for secession, no convention was held. Unionists, however, only conditionally supported the Union. They did not want any military action taken against their fellow Southern states. When Confederates fired upon Fort Sumter in Charleston Harbor on April 12, 1861, and President Lincoln called for volunteers to put down the rebellion, the die was cast for many Unionists. As Zebulon B. Vance of Asheville remembered, he learned of Fort Sumter while he was pleading for the Union with hand upraised. "When my hand came down," he recalled, "it fell slowly and sadly by the side of a secessionist." On May 20th, the state held another convention to discuss secession. The delegates to that convention voted unanimously to secede. Zeb Vance, who was to become North Carolina's wartime governor, was not the only sad person. 4 years of civil war impacted every state resident, rich or poor, free or slave, white, black, and even red. Special feature, Carolina People, Elizabeth Hobbs Keckley. "I was born a slave," Elizabeth Hobbs Keckley once wrote. "I came upon the earth free in godlike thought, but fettered in action." This Virginia native, who lived part of her life in North Carolina, however, did something about her life. She eventually gained her freedom and became a little-known but important contributor to the great fight to free the slaves during the Civil War. How? Early in life, Elizabeth found her talent and turned it into her passion. She could sew expertly, and she used her abilities as a seamstress to advance through life. Elizabeth lost her father at an early age when he was moved to the West with his master. Her mother, however, remained a strong influence in her life. As a teenager, she was separated from her mother for a time while she served as a domestic maid at a girls' school in Hillsboro. Elizabeth was made to do the work of three slaves, but scolded and treated with distrust for 5 years. More than once, she was beaten for her stubborn pride. Things got worse when Elizabeth and her mother were taken to Missouri, and her mother was made to work even though she was too old. Elizabeth said later that she decided to work my fingers to the bone to care for her mother. She used the sewing skills her mother had taught her to make enough money to buy a substitute. In fact, she was such a good seamstress that soon she was making enough money to support her bankrupted master. She continued to struggle, however, even after she bought her freedom. She and her husband, James Keckley, separated. She moved to Washington, D.C., to support her son as a single parent. There she made dresses for the wives of Robert E. Lee and Senator Jefferson Davis, the later president of the Confederacy. She was so successful that she was able to send her son to one of the first colleges to admit black students, Wilberforce University in Ohio. During the Civil War, Elizabeth's reputation gained her a really famous client, Mary Todd Lincoln. She made more than a dozen dresses for her, including Mrs. Lincoln's 1861 inaugural gown. The First Lady soon found Mrs. Keckley to be a good friend as well as a good employee. Both women lost sons during the war, and during the tense times in the White House, Elizabeth gave counsel both to the President and Mrs. Lincoln. She even sometimes brushed the President's hair before he went to give speeches. Unfortunately, after the assassination of the President in 1865, Mrs. Lincoln became ill and broke off the friendship. Elizabeth, however, kept a picture of the former First Lady with her until her death. Although Mrs. Keckley was one of the most celebrated black women of the Civil War, she died in a home for the destitute, extremely poor, in Washington, D.C. in 1907.